My name is Chris Main, M-A-I-N, and I'm with Major General G.J.J. Edwards, DFC, CD, Canadian Forces. Prior to that, the Royal Canadian Air Force during the Second War. And the date today is 4 July 1979, and we're at the University of Victoria in the Clarity Building. And I guess before we go any farther, you have no restrictions on these tapes. Is that correct, sir, that they can go to the National Archives in Ottawa?
Yes.
And be used by researchers?
Yes. No limit at all on that.
Okay, on access. Terrific. Last day we got as far, as I recall, we got as far as you had just joined 428 Squadron.
Yeah.
Had just been joining. We were talking generalities, and if we can continue with the generalities before we get into the actual specific missions themselves. I guess the first thing, just prior to the tape, we were talking about the Canadianization policy. Now, there was a Canadianization policy by the federal government to get Canadians out of the RAF and into the RCAF and into Canadian-controlled wings and groups. Like number six group, of course, the famous group. Now, you be at the tail end of this procedure. How did it affect you at all, or did it?
You say at tail end. I really don't know when it started, where it ended. Six group was long formed when I arrived. You'll recall that I arrived in the group in early March of 1944.
Mm-hmm.
Having come from an RAF OTU, Operational Training Unit, to 1659, I'm reading from my logbook, 1659 Conversion Unit, Topcliffe, Yorkshire, and that was the Conversion Unit 4-6 Group, and this was conversion onto the operational types in use in 6
mm-hmm.
Group at that period. So I started conversion onto Halifax 2s in... on March, I see here, March the 12th, 1944. But returning to the point on Canadianization, as I recall, Topcliffe was commanded by, in fact, I know it was, commanded by a Canadian group captain. 6th Group had formed, I think, and perhaps you would know, it had formed sometime in 1943.
Yes.
They had pulled together. So here I am in very early March of 1944. The conversion unit was substantially Canadian, although there was an intermix there of RAF, the odd Australian, the odd New Zealander around. But it seemed to me that it was substantially Canadian. Recollection a bit shaky here. Substantially Canadian at that time. And you see, I was a flying officer then, and these administrative matters like Canadianization or whatever were of really very little interest or consequence. We were anxious to get on with
flying anything
and get on and to get on operational squadrons.
Status, yeah.
So it would have had, it certainly had, I don't recall any impact on me and my crew, with one exception, all Canadians. The single exception was our flight engineer who was a Scotsman. It would have passed largely unnoticed in my circle.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, we were getting on with our part of the war, so if we had known about it, it was of passing interest.
What about in the mess itself? Was there talk that Canadians were being abused or overused, that type of thing in the RAF?
Again, in my group, no. It just did not occur at the time. Much later, I would now go into the later 40s, early 50s, when we began reading reports of the high percentage of Canadians throughout the RAF,
mm-hmm.
Substantially at the sharp end, operating rather than on staff. It may have been that even then we realized that outside Sixth Group headquarters, manned almost entirely by Canadians, a Canadian Air Vice Marshal, Black Mike McEwen, and all of his staff. I subsequently went on that staff. We were 99% Canadian. But I think even at that point, we began to realize that the RCF was not proportionately, I guess is the word, represented in the high echelons, in Bomber Command, that the Brits, if you like, sat on top. And
Bomber Harris and the boys?
Bomber Harris and his crowd. Very, very few Canadians. Again, uncertain knowledge, but perhaps now discussions amongst, I'm moving well forward now up to Sixth Group, where I was a wing commander. Discussions with Canadian, other Canadian wing commanders, group captains, air commodores, commenting on how little representation at Bomber Command level. Leaping well ahead, but consistent with what I'm saying, in 1950, I guess it would be, when I was secretary of the assistant secretary of the Chiefs of Staff Committee in Ottawa, that fact had visibly something to do with the road the RCAF took in the late 40s, early 50s. We then had made a conscious decision to associate with American Air Forces in terms of equipment, tactics, exchange programs, that kind of thing. We shifted sharply away from the RAF, although we continued a substantial exchange program with it. We shifted sharply away from the RAF, while the Canadian Army and the Canadian Navy continued their association with their British counterparts. We shifted gears and direction,
it can't wholly be this, but you think that's part of the reason?
Part of the reason.
A major Canadian shift to the United States,
yes,
for equipment and technology and all those things, of course,
yes,
understandably. And especially an aircraft with, it's state-of-the-art aircraft at this time as well. It's all brand new.
That's right.
All new development.
That's right.
It's mostly American.
But you see, we'd bought Vampire. The RCF had bought Vampire.
Yeah, that was an interim plane. The Vampire was, if I'm not mistaken, the Vampire was a jet that was bought in the interim until the Sabres and all these other good things could come out of the States and Canada through the.
Oh yeah, but even then we had options, and we could well have bought RAF. I was exchanged in the States at the time. I'm going to 1948, 1950 now, and the F-86 just really coming online in the States, and the Canadian decision had not been made. Mm-hmm. What fighter aircraft would be bought. And
so you think there's prejudice and...
Well, not prejudice,
well, prejudice
but realization, perhaps, or a sensation that we had been used. A sensation that we had been used. That's my own term.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever heard anyone use it quite that way. But I remember the CAS at the time... and these were in Chiefs of Staff conference, observing. He wondered how wise the Canadian Army and the Canadian Navy, the RCN and the Canadian Army, were in continuing this complete dependence, if you like, on their British counterparts. And while he certainly didn't state it boldly, he certainly left the impression that the RCF would get a better deal, again my term, get a better deal through association with the USAF. That because by then the RCF, you see, it had association with the RCF since 1920. And we had looked almost exclusively towards UK.
Yeah.
So World War II experience of large numbers of operational aircrew and really a disproportionately few senior positions galled, no question.
So the analogy could almost be the Canadian Army's representation in the First War with the Imperial War Cabinet.
Yes.
I guess the analogy could be similar.
Yes, yes.
I'm thinking as well to compound these things would be, well, with NATO and the Americans' strong involvement in NATO and Canada's commitment combined with NORAD, which comes on later down the line.
Yes.
Which is where you're unifying your air defenses for North America. It'd be kind of silly to be driving the wrong kind of plane.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. But as you know, every time we have purchased an aircraft since the end of World War II, there were always British and European as well as American options.
Yes.
And almost without exception, and I would suggest perhaps the single exception was the purchase of the Falcon, was it Dassault Falcon that we bought from France, a little transport twin jet. But every other purchase, we had a hard look at what Europe and UK had to offer, and invariably, am I right? I think so. Invariably decided on onshore, North American onshore.
Well, the parts and everything else, training.
I think too, going back to what I was saying about the chief of the air staff consciously moving us away from the Brits. This question of offshore onshore purchasing in the event of an emergency, and deprivation of good channels of transport and delivery transatlantic from Europe to us, say,
it's still a vital concern. Yeah.
Still, but it made enormous logistic sense to him then.
Well,
if the aircraft was otherwise acceptable to buy here,
too.
I would think, you know, that was economic sense. And
when you mentioned the Vampire, I know we're jumping way ahead, but when you mentioned the Vampire, if I'm not mistaken, part of the Vampire deal was to help Britain on its balance of payments, like for money it owed Canada.
I recall that vaguely. I can't really talk to it.
So that's why we had the Vampire for that short period of time, is to help the Brits along and give them something to produce. Back to 44, March 1944. Yeah. We got off there.
One can leap forward.
Yeah. No, but I think it is all part and parcel of the same type of thing. Generally speaking, you mentioned last time that nobody really came along and took you under his wing, so to speak, to show you the ropes when you joined the squadron. You were expected to be a competent pilot and understand the theory and the practicalities of operational flight. Is that correct? Did I understand that properly?
Yeah, if I said it that way, I perhaps overstated it. Of course, you were welcomed by the CO of the squadron. You were placed in a particular flight. You had a flight commander, and each in addition, there were the sections: the pilot section, the navigator section, the radio, and so on, combined sort of professional groupings. That were subdivided then operationally into A and B or C flights. So you certainly were shown the ropes. You were told what to do. You had no idea, because there was still a great secrecy around it, how an operation was mounted. You know, where did you have to be when? What did you have to do? We had never attended a briefing. We had never attended an operational briefing, because they held operational briefings for reasons of security, secrecy. They held it to those that had to be there, nobody else. If you started adding to that, you increased the risk of a security leak. So all of that was ahead of us and brand new. But you were you met the personalities, you listened to the great tales of bravery and cowardice around the bar or in flight rooms on rainy days, sort of thing. But you were checked out on the equipment, and very quickly after arrival, the captain of the crew was taken on, as second pilot, was taken on the first real operational flight. But there was no sense of being rushed into operations prematurely. You know, you were there to operate. You'd gone through all of your conversion, your operational training, your conversion onto type. You knew your equipment quite well, its capabilities and limitations. So you were ready and really anxious to get going. You know, there's great excitement. There was always great excitement.
Mm-hmm.
Off on ops tonight. And after this first operational flight that I took in, when did I say? It's in me book here. When was it? I went off on my first, well, I went off with the flight commander of my flight, a fellow named Squadron Leader McLeish, who subsequently killed himself in CF-100s over in Europe years later. But he took me off to Paris on the night of the 25th of March. I had left Topcliffe Conversion Unit on the 22nd of March, presumably took a day, the 23rd of March, to get settled, to get moved up to Ghost Squadron with my crew, to 428 Squadron with my crew.
And you'd be stationed where?
That was in Middleton, St. George, in, I think it was County Durham. It was the top end of the Vale of York. So I moved up there on the 23rd. The 24th was sort of squadron shakedown, administrative matters. And here on the night of the 25th, I was off on my first flight with the with my flight commander to...
Now you were deaf, what, co-pilot?
Co-pilot, yeah.
Keep your hands off everything?
Keep your hands off everything. Keep your mouth shut and just listen. You know, watch. We'll discuss it when I get back. And if we're attacked or something, here's what you do. If I'm shot up, you fly the airplane. That kind of very basic stuff. Crews were... It was my first experience with another crew in mm-hmm. on a proper operational flight, and I was impressed with the discipline. There was absolutely no chit-chat over the intercom within the aircraft, and of course no contact outside until you got over the target, and then you listened out on a specified frequency for the master of ceremonies to give you some directions and where to bomb the target indicators. But very little chat going over. The only thing you'd get at regular, irregular intervals would be the skipper himself checking with all positions, tail gunner okay, skipper, mid-upper gunner okay, flight engineer okay. He'd do that several times an hour to make sure that there was no disconnect amongst mm-hmm. the crew itself.
Was there any fear that you could, how should I phrase this, that your tail gunner, for example, could be somehow or other injured during flight or become ill or whatever and not know that he was incapacitated?
Well, that was the reason for this intercom check.
Not just to check the system itself.
No, no, to make sure that everybody was online.
Okay.
And
just wanted to make the distinction there.
That's right. That everybody was online and operating, and
not snoring.
Not snoring, although one suspected that it happened from time to time. I remember in my case, we're coming back from, this is several months later, coming back from, I think it was Stettin, and we still hadn't crossed the German border, heading west back to. Back to Middleton, and I did my check with my tail gunner, and his reply was not okay, skipper, but swing around, skipper. And that, you know, we laughed at the time, but that used to be what the tail gunner would say on the ground when you were taxiing back into dispersal, rather tight dispersals. He would give you some direction about where your tail was. On or off concrete. And his standard was, okay, swing around, skipper. So here we are airborne over Germany on the way home, and my tail gunner clearly had fallen asleep. I woke him up, and he looked out and thought he was on the ground. I said, swing around, skipper. And but the gunners regularly reported any any activity that they thought should be brought to the attention of the skipper and the crew. You could spot other aircraft in flight at night, and you never wanted one to get too close. And of course, if they spotted any fighter aircraft, you could well be directed by either gunner to go into a fighter evasion tactic that we generically called a corkscrew.
What do you mean by a corkscrew?
What
is the actual corkscrew?
You violently maneuvered the aircraft in a circular motion, sharp dive, sharp climb, turning like so. I'm doing it with my hands here, but
yeah.
It looked like an erratic corkscrew in the air, in the flight.
You wouldn't be literally going around on your axis, or...?
No, you'd dive like that, then get to the bottom and turn it sharply up and climb back up. All of this, by the way, if you were going into your target with a full load with bombs, and of course these things up at altitude weren't damn... You could lose altitude quickly enough. You had a hell of a time
getting back up.
And if you were attacked or thought you were under some kind of an attack, and you started this, remember too that you were in the bomber stream, and as you did this violent maneuver... There was always the risk that you could fly right down on a bomber below you or climb up into one above you. And you used the corkscrew only when you thought you were about to be attacked. And you always turned into the direction of the attack in a violent maneuver. I had occasion to use it a few times. We were fired on by German night fighters, but we were never hit, and I don't think they ever were in a terribly good position vis-a-vis our aircraft to deliver an effective attack.
Now, would you be taught this tactic
early on, in basic, right back in
OTU or before that?
OTU.
What about formation flying?
No formation flying at night. You just flew in as individual crews in a stream at a prescribed altitude. And this stream, I say prescribed altitude because to give some measure of protection so that the whole glump didn't decide to go into 20,000 feet, the whole bomber stream was scattered through several thousand feet. I've forgotten the interval, but I should think something like at 500 foot intervals. So if you happen to be... If you're at the top altitude, at say 20,000 feet, down below you, behind you, around you, in front of you, very few seen at night, except you could sometimes see the flaming stubs of aircraft sliding under you and moving around under you and above. You'd have upwards to 1,000 aircraft spaced vertically and a time space as well to afford some measure. And it was highly successful, one believes.
Well, what about the chance of being struck by falling bombs as you're flying? Now, you know,
we were told, you see, the
odds were against it.
The odds were totally against it. And indeed, theoretically, if the highest aircraft went in first at altitude and dropped their bombs, theoretically, there would be no aircraft below them, and as they were stepped down and time spread behind, it looked like a flying wedge, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And theoretically, you were never dropping bombs on anyone below you, but that was only the theory. And we know aircraft came back with great chunks out of their wings and some fuselage. Bombs had gone through wings, had gone through fuselages, but they hadn't been fused at the time. Clearly, they'd have been blown out of the aircraft would have been blown out of the sky. And I don't know if anyone knows how many were struck by own bombs in flight. I have never seen a study of that.
It's something that wasn't discussed, I guess.
And wasn't discussed, and we were so. We so believe that our tactics were best against the enemy and best for our own protection for the reasons we're discussing now,
mm-hmm.
that we didn't spend a lot of time worrying about it, really.
What about arming the bombs and things like that and the types of mixes? Now, this would be all determined back at base, I assume.
Right, yeah, for the particular target.
Payload target and ratio and... You can give the speeds as well, is that not correct? Like you were to return at X knots?
That as much for fuel consumption and spread for the landing of the aircraft back at base as anything.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking more of the fuel consumption, that it was timed and worked out so carefully.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, that...
Wasn't much left when you got back. And if you'd beaten your engines to get home early...
You'd end up in the channel.
You'd end up somewhat short of base anyway.
But I
guess on every squadron they had, what did we call them? The chaps who just had to be first getting home. To the extent that we began to post, I guess it was in the flight engineer section and the pilot section, we began to post best consumption figures. And you could see that those that had beaten their engines to get home first always had the high consumption
so
figures.
They were the bad guys.
And they were the bad guys, and they were told to slow down, or you know, they were reprimanded in some form.
Let me take a pause here and check the machine. We're back.
You're watching the time, Chris, aren't you?
Yes, I'm watching your time. We've got another 20 minutes or so, sir.
No more than that, eh?
Well, it's 10 after 3 now, so...
Well, I'm good until quarter to 4.
Quarter to 4.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, half an hour. 35 minutes. I was just thinking, now, on the armament, now, would that be done by armors on the ground? Your people
yes.
have nothing to do with that sort
no.
of thing?
We had no hand in armament selection. This filtered down from Bomber Command.
Mm-hmm.
Bomber Command would decide what targets in what cities, what areas.
What speed, what height,
the tactics. Because probably if it was a sizable raid, there would be at least two groups involved, and I don't know how many squadrons. And all of that had to be, that was worked out. Once the decision was made that target X was to be handled, I guess that decision was probably made very early on the morning of the night on which the raid would take place. And it would be a combination of, at Bomber Command level, and at group level too for that matter, a combination of met conditions and targets, the selection of the armament, certainly. All of that decided long before the crews ever assembled for the operational briefing. And indeed, as you sat around in the afternoon of the night of the raid, it was great scurrying around the dispersals, you could see bomb loads coming out of bomb dumps going up to your aircraft. You wouldn't know what they were putting on your aircraft. It could be all 1,000 pounders or 500 or a mix. It could be a lot of incendiaries. It could even be a leaflet raid or mines if you just didn't know.
How did you feel when you went on leaflet raids?
I was only on one. Very often we had leaflets in addition to a bomb load.
We weren't just going out there to waste time.
You weren't going out just to throw paper at them. But the mining operations were terribly interesting. I was on mining operations all the way from the Norwegian fjord leading up to Oslo, down the west coast of Europe. I guess Saint Nazaire in France. Was it Saint Nazaire, the
mm-hmm.
submarine pens?
Yep.
Was that it? We mined off those submarine pens with great frequency. I don't know how. Mining was called gardening. Never did discover what it meant, but I see I gardened off Heligoland Bight, gardened off Le Havre, gardened off Kiel, went up I guess off the Kiel Canal and gardened there, gardened Saint Nazaire, Brest, Lorient, gardening off Heligoland again, gardening off the Amsterdam Hook. And you gardened at a fairly low level. I think it was below 1,000 feet.
Now, will this be taught at OTU as well?
No, that wasn't... we really didn't...
On the job training.
And we didn't know what a fully bombed up aircraft felt like until we finally flew it ourselves.
And they wouldn't put dummy bricks in or anything to find
Never loaded up that way, no. And I suppose one can understand, there was always the risk of crashing on takeoff, and you were told that you're going to have a very, very heavy aircraft. You were told what the liftoff speed was probably going to be. And that's about as far as the training went. Every now and then, and there was no way to train for this, of course, every now and then an operation would be canceled for some reason or other while we were airborne. And I remember by the summer of 1944, there was a bomb shortage, aerial bomb shortage. So we were not to waste bombs. Normally, if you were canceled in flight, you went off into the North Sea to a dump area, and you just pulled the toggle and dropped your whole load and came back home and landed. But with this bomb shortage, we weren't going to waste.
These bombs were armed, though.
these were armed. Oh yes, they were operational, and all they had to do was spin off
the
safety on the fuse and usually in the nose of the bomb, and they were live, fully live. And certainly, if you crashed and burned, those things went off. But in any event, we were told to bring our bombs back on this particular one. Got back to our base, and it was in the evening, or late evening, still light, but quite dark. And I was by now a flight commander, and was given the great honor of putting the first aircraft back on the ground with a bomb load on it. And we knew that because of the weight of the aircraft, that certainly our approach speed had to be greater than if you were going in with a light aircraft. Your stall speed would rise because of the weight of the thing. I took one pass of the field and obviously came in too hot, so overshot, came around, and got the bird down, and got it down roughly where one would put down a light aircraft, not realizing that the momentum of the aircraft with its greater weight was so much greater now. Never did... ran out of runway, went right through a potato field at the end of the runway, and knew that if... by now the aircraft was slowing down quite a bit. I had it under control, but couldn't get the damn thing stopped on the runway. And then had to pour the power to it in the potato field and do a wide swing to get it back up on the tarmac. Well, they took... I was one of the more experienced pilots in the squadron. They took one look at this performance from the control tower, and the code word was, get your bombs back out to the North Sea and drop them up there. I think they were afraid of losing too many potatoes, but it scared the hell out of me. I never landed a super heavy aircraft again. I say super heavy. The thing was only about 65,000 pounds.
Relatively speaking.
At that time, yeah. it was a very very heavy aircraft, and we knew that we were going to roll more, but we couldn't believe we were going to roll so far.
Well, what is the braking system now on the... now you're on, first of all, on the Halifax,
yeah.
Now, could you reverse engines type of thing? Like,
no.
That's a jet specialty now, is they reverse engines.
Well, you could... no, there were other aircraft reciprocating engines that you could reverse later on, much later on. But we had no reversing. We had... you were lucky if you had... and it varied with the mark of the airplane. Certainly, most of the older bombers had an air compressor system. They were air brakes, mm-hmm. And as you squeeze the handle on the wheel of your control column, you put the brakes on. And if you had your rudders straight ahead, lined up, both feet extended the same distance, and you squeeze the handle, you got equal braking pressure to both drums on both undercarriages, left and right wheel, so that if you wanted to do a turn to the left, you'd put your left rudder forward, and that would be the only one that would grab. Or if you wanted to turn right, you'd put your right rudder forward, and that would grab. But you ran out of air very quickly, and this is something you used to beat into the new pilots coming into the squadron. You know, go easy on braking. Don't taxi too quickly. Go easy on braking, because you could, and I did on a couple of occasions. I ran out of air before I got off the runway and around to my dispersal. Then you just had to sit there and run your engines faster than you would have wished. Mind you, you had very little braking left now to build up to have the compressor build up enough air again so that you could more safely taxi around to dispersal. The old air bottle system, I guess, was extensively used, and it was the best technique of the period, but it was a very primitive system. The hydraulic system was differential braking with a hydraulic system was a vastly superior one, and it seems to me that by the time the Lancasters came around, we had the Canadian Lancaster certainly had a hydraulic braking system.
How much difficulty brakes burning out?
I've seen brakes catch fire. But for all the lack of extensive training and extensive experience, we handle the aircraft pretty well, not badly.
Okay. Thinking, we're talking generalities again. Before I get into there's two things I want to hit. First of all, escape drill and parachute drill and this type of thing. Now, what are they saying? Now, would this be trained at OTU as well?
Either OTU or between OTU and heavy conversion unit, you were given an escape and evasion course that lasted about, I'm a little fuzzy on this, about, I seem to me that it was less than a week. And I don't even have it down in my record of service, so I suspect it was just about OTU time. And in there they taught you all they could about night evasion, escape. They would take you off in a sealed van and drive you round and round, and then suddenly dump you in the middle of the night in some forlorn place and say, find your way back to base.
Would you take it as a big joke or what?
No, it wasn't a joke in the sense that you were dumped, and usually your whole crew. We were crewed by then, so it would be after OTU. Your whole crew would be dumped, and there here would be six, seven of us out in the boonies, and we were warned that if we were caught before we got back to base, they'd put us back in the van again and take us somewhere else, and you'd stay out there until you got back and evaded the screening forces that
were home guard or what?
Be home guard, or could be some regiment out night training, and this would be great fun for them to capture an Air Force crew and put them back in the van and shove them back out further. We happily made it first time. But there you were showed some of the escape and evasion devices, magnetic buttons and maps sewn into your jacket or hat.
It's got a little map pouch.
Little map pouch, and you saw the kind of money that. Oh, by the way, on ops, you were issued with an escape and evasion pouch that you stuck into your battle dress blouse, and it contained. I never did open one because I never had to, but it contained money, and you had things like pipes that you could break, and a needle would fall out to give you a magnetic north, and what were some of the others now? I brought a handful of them home, and I've forgotten what they were now. But that was about all you got. Perhaps a few. They tried to give you a little German vocabulary that might help you. But it was pretty basic stuff. And as far as parachute training, escape from the aircraft, you did your own drills in the aircraft. You knew where the escape hatches were, and
because you weren't parachute trained.
We weren't parachute trained.
Mm-hmm. Pause here for 30 seconds.
I forgot that one.
Anyway, that's when we said the package there. I thought it was movie Strange.
Yeah.
It sort of cracked me up.
Yeah.
Now this is going to be a toughie. What about the social life in the squadron? Before we get into the actual operational flights, what about the social life? Now, would you have a proper mess facility? Number one.
Yeah, Middleton St. George was a permanent RAF base. There were the so-called permanent bases and the so-called satellite bases.
Mm-hmm.
And Middleton St. George was a permanent base.
Two squadrons on the base? Or?
Two squadrons on the base of it seems to be about 20 aircraft each, so there'd be about 40 Lancs or Halifaxes or a combination, plus other small aircraft. When I first arrived as a flying officer, we lived in Nissen huts, sort of well off the camp. It would be about a 10 or 15 minute walk to the mess for breakfast food. By the time I left Middleton St. George, I was a squadron leader, and I had moved into almost a suite of rooms. It was Oriental luxury compared to living in barrack block conditions in Nissen huts. But it was sparsely furnished, but comfortable. You could always get a glass of beer. I think we had one or two bottles of scotch per night and a bit of gin. Hard liquor was very, very hard to come by. And most of us really weren't drinking hard liquor in those days. A pint of beer was considered very adequate. I don't ever recall a so-called party in the mess. But you always had your favorite pub somewhere in the vicinity. It would be literally a squadron pub that a squadron would adopt, if you like, and tend to use more than anything else.
What about bar stewards and things like this? Now, would you have RCF people as?
No, it seems to me that the domestic staff, certainly in Middleton St. George, was exclusively RAF. A lot of WAFs used in the dining rooms. I think the cooks, there may have been the odd Canadian cook out there, but I don't remember seeing, and the bar stewards certainly were British. Some of them, I suspect, had been around there since the late 30s. You know, they almost went with the station.
Mm-hmm. Family
retainers. they're forever. And Middleton St. George survived as an operational base well into the 50s, I'm told. It eventually became a night fighter squadron with the RAF. But it was if you've seen one permanent pre-World War II RAF station, you've seen them all. Pretty standard stuff. A ring of houses. That were married quarters for officers pre World War II, now occupied and probably doubled up as single room accommodation for officers around. Inevitably, Nissen huts stuck in odd places for either accommodation or storage. We were lucky in Middleton St. George. We had a squash court. That was almost standard in that type of permanent RAF station from the pre-World War II period. Practically no heat. I remember that vividly.
What about the food and things? good, bad, indifferent.
Fantastically poor. One can't remember really, really enjoying. But you ate it. You ate it, and you. We were hungry all the time. But we had We had parcels from home and tins of this. And,
You weren't living in regimental splendor, I guess, is what I'm getting at in comparison.
Nothing could be further from regimental splendor than this. It was clean and it was dry and it was not unpleasant. But regimental splendor does not readily come to mind as the description.
What about uniform thing now? You're an officer now, and are we just getting your stock standard uniform off the rack, or were you getting involved in the tailor business and this type of thing?
I had gone across with a couple of uniforms and a battle dress. You tended to live in battle dress,
mm-hmm.
night and day. And the only time you tended to get into a uniform was when you were, say, going off on leave. But I think you could wear battle dress on leave in those periods, as long as it was presentable. I didn't worry about new uniforms, I guess, until for at least a year, and then had uniforms built by, I think Gieves had a branch in Harrogate, and went in and had.
So the naval tailor went into the Air Force tailoring as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. Gieves was big RAF business too.
They knew where the bucks were.
They knew where the money was, and but did very well by us. And when you went up to town, you always dropped into Gieves to buy something. It was amazing what you could buy. As late as late 44, early 45, still not bad stock. You could still have shirts made, and the selection of shirting material was surprised me.
Hmm. Now,
one never felt. I remember buying slacks in Oxford. I was down on leave with an RAF friend, and his father was a chaplain at Oxford, in fact, and we went around to his father's tailor. And bought slacks, and couldn't have cuffs. So because we couldn't have cuffs, we had to have cuffs on our civvies.
You couldn't have your cuffs on your uniform.
That's right. And we somehow talked this poor tailor. He was beaten into it.
Why? Because of the shortage of material.
Because of shortage of material, it was not a criminal offense, but it was very much against the law to have cuffs built, and tailors were so directed. But we somehow persuaded this, telling the man we'd never tell where we got it.